Why recreate these ancient beverages?
Well, that's a good question. We'd like to be able to know more about how they were made. And we have the ingredients generally that we can get with chemical analysis, botanical analysis, and so forth. But were they really tasty? Were they palatable to the ancient sensory apparatus or not? And in order to try to get a better handle on that question and also the process question of how they're actually made, we do the recreations. It's called experimental archaeology.
Now, you draw a distinction between, say, beer, wine, mead, and something you refer to as extreme fermented beverages. What are they?
Well, the extreme fermented beverages are the ones that we discovered, really, because we sort of assume today that everything's kind of divided up very neatly into wine, beer, mead. But when you start getting all sorts of fruits, honey, different carbohydrate, natural products mixed together, then we refer to it as an extreme fermented beverage.
And what kind of things were our forebears fermenting?
Well, we came out of Africa, so originally we would have been able probably to process different kinds of fruits, dates, figs. In South Africa, you have the marula fruit. Honey in temperate climates is pretty much universal, so it's the highest concentration of sugar in nature. So humans would have recognized early where the beehives were located and sought those out. And it's not too difficult, actually, to get fermentation going with honey or with high sugar fruits. Now, carbohydrates, roots, wild grain and so forth, such as millet and sorghum in Africa, would have been more difficult. But we think that they would have been chewing it. And we have an enzyme in our saliva that breaks down carbohydrates into sugar. And then by adding a yeast source, such as from a high-sugar fruit, you can get the fermentation going. But the idea of the extreme beverages seems to have been to combine different ingredients to get higher sugar, higher alcohol, but also to put into solution perhaps herbs or tree resins that have medicinal effects.
So they were looking at these not perhaps as we do today as purely recreational, but they had a use.
Exactly. So the recreational side is important, of course, and the mind-altering effect is very crucial in all cultures around the world. But they would have also had an interest in the social value of fermented beverages, breaking down the boundaries between individuals in a group. We call that social lubrication. Also, because of the mind-altering effect and the mystery of fermentation itself, they associated fermented beverages, beginning in Africa, but then around the world, with different religions. And so there was like an outside force at work in the mind-altering effect and the fermentation process that then led people to combine that with religious feelings as well. And so in our Western religions, wine, grape wine, is the primary fermented beverage in many of the ceremonies. But in Africa, they often put the brewery for making millet or sorghum beer right at the center of the village. So it becomes the center of social relations and religion. And I should also mention that as humans came out of Africa, they had to adapt different other natural products that were available in the other regions to figure out how to ferment those. So if you got up into the Middle East, barley and wheat are the primary grains. You have grape appearing there for the first time and different other fruits. And as you move across to Asia, you have rice and, again, millet. And the Americas, you have corn. And then other products, like in the Americas, chocolate was quite important, too, as a fermented beverage.
I suppose it's probably impossible to know for sure, but is there a theory about how our ancestors discovered that if you did a certain thing with these plants that you would get alcohol?
Well, we don't have the information, unfortunately, from the Paleolithic period going back millions of years, you know, when hominids and then humans developed in Africa. Unfortunately, we have no containers as such. They probably were made of organic materials like woven grass, a gourd, wood and so forth, and those have all disappeared. So for most of human history, we don't have containers that we can do the chemical analysis on. It's when we finally get down to the period when they invent pottery that we have a chance to get the organic, ancient organics out of the container and then reconstruct what the original beverage was. But we assume that because we're set up to drink fermented beverages, the right physiology and genetics, we pick up the aroma of alcohol and all the fermented aromas and tastes, and then we have enzymes in our liver and elsewhere in our gut that change the sugar and the alcohol into energy. So it's a primary energy source that humans would have discovered this quite early. Now, if you have a high sugar fruit and you exude, press out the juice, that has yeast associated with the high sugar fruit that will start the fermentation quite naturally. And it's like the ideal medium, the juice, the fruit juice, for fermentation. So that would be easily discoverable. And then with honey, if you dilute it 3 parts honey, 7 parts water, the yeast become active in the honey and again produce a mead. And so you could imagine that humans, you know, would have known where the beehives were if they were in a rotten tree that fell over. You had a big rainstorm, it filled up with water. Along comes our ancestor and notices that there's some sort of different taste and aroma coming out from the beehive. They take a taste, they get the mind-altering effect, and I think that would have been easily discoverable as well.
In your latest book, Ancient Brews, you draw a pretty direct connection between fermenting alcoholic beverages and the advent of civilization. Could you talk about that?
Right. So you have the social lubrication factor here, the medicinal effects, the religious effects, which bring people together and, you know, have a common goal. But once you get down to the beginning of pottery making and the Neolithic period, when they start to domesticate plants and animals, on the plant side, you have, say, in the Middle East or in China, you have barley, wheat in the Middle East, and millet and rice over in China. And about the same time, around 9,000 years ago, they seem to have domesticated those plants. Now, what would be the purpose of doing that? Now, there's been a longstanding anthropological question about the rise of civilization and which came first, bread or beer. And there's no easy answer to this question, but I think because of the mind-altering effect in particular and the importance of these fermented beverages in human culture, that beer would precede bread, and it's a bit more easy to make. And if you have a fruit like grape that you're also collecting either in the wild or you've begun to domesticate it, again, you have something that really ferments very easily. So it then leads on to people settling down in those regions where you're domesticating the plants and making the beer or wine or mead to set up year-round villages, permanent settlements. And so this is the beginning of human civilization, you could say. And there's other factors involved, of course, but I think fermented beverages play a very large role in this. And it's been overlooked largely. Now, in the last 20 years, we've started to see a resurgence of interest in this whole field.
I gather that even once you discover through chemical analysis what kinds of materials were being used to create these ancient beverages, that actually recreating them is not easy.
It can be difficult. We go through a lot of experiments to try to figure out, you know, how to do it. And especially when you have so many different ingredients, you know, these extreme beverages or mixed beverages, the fermentation sometimes is a little difficult. You have to have the right yeast and other microorganisms to really get things going. We try to source the ingredients in our ancient ales to as close as we can to what the original authentic natural products would have been. And that's sometimes difficult too. So if you're dealing with Chinese ingredients like hawthorn fruit, or even the yeast and microorganisms that go with it, it can be very challenging to get those pieces of the puzzle and then try the experiments to see if we can get something that's palatable.
Are you generally satisfied with the results of your speculations in this area?
They seem to, you know, keep adding up to making a very reasonable picture. I mean, there's lots of possibilities. One of the reasons I wrote the book was to put out sort of all the factors that go into doing a recreated beverage. And so others, like home brewers, there are recipes, you know, for the home brewer to try. They can play upon the different variables and see what other possibilities there are. And, you know, slowly but surely, you know, as you get more information archaeologically and also from the experimental work, I think, you know, we're narrowing down the possibilities. But in general, I've been very happy with, especially working with Dogfish Head Brewery. You've got an owner and brewer, Sam Calagione, who is almost like a Neolithic brewer. And he's got all the imagination and flair and so forth to really carry this off and a sense, you know, of what's going to work. So, you know, combining, you know, both the academic side, which I do, and the experimental side, you know, we have a nice working relationship.
How would you describe how these ancient beverages taste to the modern palate?
I think they're surprising at first. And when we did our first one, was the Midas beverage from Turkey, from the Phrygian capital at Gordion, where Midas was a real king and ruled there. In his burial, we did the chemical analysis and recreated that. That was the first one we did around the year 2000. There wasn't this sort of experimentation going on among home brewers, or people's palates hadn't really expanded yet. We were still sort of back in the Coors and Bud Light phase, you know, where everything is pretty much standardized in the four main components of the German Reinheitsgebot, the purity law, where you only use hops, barley, water, and yeast. So when we came out with Midas Touch, which was instead of hops, which came much later, we used saffron and as the bittering agent, and it also had honey and it had grapes and barley, you know, all mixed together. You know, a lot of people were sort of taken aback. They liked it. Now we've come, you know, 20 years later nearly, and people are throwing fruits into the IPAs and playing around with all kinds of things. So I think the palate, especially in the United States, but now increasingly around the world, is becoming much broader like it was in ancient times.
Do you have any particular favorites of the ones you've recreated? You describe a number of them in the book.
Right. Well, my favorite is the Chinese one, because it's called Chateau Jiahu. It's named after the site in the Yellow River Valley of China, because it is the earliest alcoholic beverage we've yet identified anywhere. So it goes back 9,000 years, 7,000 BC. And it has something similar to the Midas beverage. It has a combination of grape, probably a wild grape. China has many species of wild grape, not the one that we're accustomed to, but very high sugar and flavorful and so forth. Then it had hawthorn fruit, which came as a surprise. I hadn't really expected that. And then rice, which, you know, you have in sake, in Chinese rice beers, and then honey. So it really, to me, is like the one beverage that kind of encapsulates, you know, our whole goal is to push, you know, the fermented beverage story back even further. I guess Midas would come second because it was the first one we did and one of the more exciting ones, and got a lot of publicity, and it's still produced today. Every month they turn it out. And, you know, I have to say of the other seven or so that are talked about in the book, I mean, the chocolate one from Central America is very interesting. The one from Scandinavia that has special Nordic fruits like lingonberry, bog cranberry, special spices like bog myrtle, yarrow, and so forth that are growing up in the north. and it were the customary bittering agents before hops all through the Middle Ages. Those are also very exciting. I mean, they're all, you know, coming from different areas of the world, so they all have their own sort of natural product mixture that's very intriguing.
What would you say is, if you will, the future of paleo beverages? Are there a lot of people on an amateur basis trying to recreate these?
There are many people now. I get emails all the time, you know, from home brewers asking about it. And now that this book is out, you know, I get asked to go to all sorts of home brewer conferences. And it appeals, I think, to a sort of scientific mind, experimental type of person who really wants to, you know, push the envelope, you could say, who, you know, has an ability to, you know, put together the mathematics and the, but also has an artistic sense, you know, of how to make a beverage like this and what the conditions are that you really need. So it's sort of like, for me, I like playing golf. I mean, it's sort of like playing golf in a way. You've got to figure out, you know, the terrain, the wind, the weather, and so forth, and then, you know, adapt it to that particular course and know what club to use and how to hit the ball.
Now, you've talked a little bit about your relationship with the Dogfish Head Brewery and its bringing some of these ancient beverages back. Has this work, though, more broadly affected the modern brewing industry, do you think?
Well, Midas Touch has definitely affected the modern industry because it is still available. You know, it's commercially available. And it also set the scene, you know, for the development, I think, of the fruity IPAs and, you know, really doing much more experimental kinds of brewing. And so you see it sort of, especially in the craft brewing industry, it's had a big effect. But then even the major producers that control the marketplace, I mean, they're buying up the craft breweries as much as possible and also trying to do their own versions of this at a lower price to sort of, you know, beat out the competition, you could say. I think it's a movement that is going to go forward, especially in other parts of the world, too.
Something that's kind of taken off here in Michigan, and I think in other states as well, has been a craft distilling outlets, you know, doing their own vodkas, right, bourbons, whiskeys, and that sort of thing. Is there a similar kind of thing going on with that kind of beverage?
Well, yes. I mean, you know, they're trying out different aging procedures. It's not as inventive, I wouldn't say, yet, as the brewing industry, but I mean, Dogfish Head does have their own distilling unit. So we did do some experiments that are mentioned, you know, in the last chapter of the book that I wrote about taking various types of Mexican natural products like agave, that, of course, goes into tequila, but also other fruits, guava and prickly pear and so forth, that we have evidence of in prehistoric caves going back 10,000 years, and we made up a sort of pulque, you call it, you know, like with agave, a naturally fermented beverage. Then you distill it as a mezcal, which is the more traditional version of tequila. So we've done that, and that came out very well, too. I mean, in the distilling process, you lose some of the aromatics, which is unfortunate. But you, you know, of course, you up the alcohol and you have other sorts of tastes and aromas that are produced in that process. So we hope to develop that side of things much more. And I think the same thing is going to happen in the craft distilling industry as well. It's just a very exciting endeavor. And I hope, you know, people come out to hear my lecture, obviously, at Western Michigan University, and I hope others will come to the Midas Feast in the evening because they'll enjoy not just Midas Touch, but also some other very innovative beverages from Dogfish Head. Hear about, you know, how we developed Midas Touch, and then have the paired meal that went with Midas Touch at the funerary feast back in 700 BC. So when the king was buried, they had a funerary feast to celebrate his rule, sort of like a Irish wake or whatever. And then after they finished the meal, they took all the dishes. You know, there was still leftovers in them, including the beverage. But also there was the entree that was served at the funerary feast, which had residue left in some of the jars that were then put into the tomb. And our analysis showed that to be a spicy barbecued lamb or goat stew with lentils. And you might not think a stew is exactly a kingly food, but it has very high protein in this case. And of course, the beverage itself had lots of antioxidants and protein and so on. So it turns out that that particular stew is still served at marriage festivals in Turkey today. And it is something that each chef, you know, can adapt for the occasion. And I'm just looking forward to tasting that because I've had many Midas feasts in the last 20 years and seeing what that particular chef comes up with and how it pairs with the Midas touch.